Hello and welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Our vision is that no one is excluded from the joy, fulfillment and lifelong benefits of sport. It's June 2024 and this year marks Women in Sport's 40th anniversary. Women and girls belong in sport, but we are less active than men and boys at every stage of our lives and the knock-on effects are profound. 2 million women in England and Wales have osteoporosis. 9 in 10 people hospitalised with eating disorders are female. The cumulative impact of this on society, the economy and the NHS should be obvious to any government. In this episode, we're tackling what needs to be done to address the staggering physical and mental health inequalities women and girls face. My name is Julia George. I'm a journalist, broadcaster and former gymnast. Welcome to the Women in Sport podcast.
If we increase the amount of PE that girls are having every week, but that PE is delivered by a teacher who doesn't understand gender stereotyping, who doesn't understand female puberty, that potentially is worse for the girls than just having 1 hour a week with a really brilliant teacher who completely understands it all.
We're so grateful to be here. We'll just fit in. We'll wear the men's kit. It's fine. Now, in the last few years, things have changed. It's like, actually, do you know what? We're not small men.
From the very smallest micro community club through to the major national governing bodies, if you're going to fly this flag around getting more women and girls into your sport, into your club, into your community, who is the first person they meet?
Imagine lifting up a Malteser with your anus and then taking it forward and dropping it.
You can join in now.
And, yeah. And you have one of those.
Sport can transform lives. Everyone knows men and boys learn resilience, courage, self-belief and a sense of belonging from sport. And their achievements are applauded throughout their lives. Not so much for women and girls. 27% of women do less than 30 minutes of sporting activity each week. Just 3% of women play in a sports team. 22% fewer girls than boys take part in team sport. Stigma, prejudice and taboos about sport, gender and health are holding women and girls back. This episode of our podcast looks at how we help the UK step up and recognise the value and importance of sport to women and girls. With me are Gary Laybourne, the CEO of Coach Corps. It's a charity which creates sports coaching apprenticeships across the UK. Gary's been a coach since he was 17 and has won medals at major world, European and national triathlon championships. Rachel Williams works for Women in Sport in policy and public affairs, managing our relationships with politicians, decision makers and government. Rachel says that sport has definitely changed her life for the better. And Dr. Bella Smith was labelled not particularly sporty at school, a label she says took years to ditch. She's now a passionate distance runner and she's a co-founder of the Well HQ, a movement that aims to help girls and women feel they truly belong in sport. Welcome all of you to the Women in Sport podcast. Bella, I'd love to start with you. That not particularly sporty label, you've gone from that to running an ultra marathon. You certainly proved them wrong, whoever said that to you. But that label, that should never be applied to any woman or girl, should it?
No, it shouldn't. And I think looking back, I think I was sporty in my own little way, but I didn't conform to the norms. I wasn't in the first for this and the first for that and the hockey and the netball and all those sports that are sort of seen, aren't they, at school as being really important. And you're right, as time has gone on, I have found what I like to do and how I want to move my body. And I have a daughter now and I'm so determined to find her the sport that she feels she wants to do and not try and squidge her into a box or a hole that says that this is the sport that young girls have to do at this age. And that's why I feel very passionate, yes, about the Well and getting girls moving.
We'll get on in a few minutes to what happens in schools now, as well as what happened in our day. Rachel, let's pick up on that label, mm-hmm. that label that someone's not particularly sporty. You're essentially saying to them, inactivity is fine. Because we've stuck that label on you and that means you won't be particularly active. Inactivity is not fine. What does Women in Sport say about what it does to women and girls?
I'm not going to go super stat heavy in this podcast. Everyone will be pleased to know. But just to give you a few to set up the debate. Women spend 25% more of their life in poor health and disability than men do. 50% of women over 50 will experience osteoporosis in their lives, and 50% of women over 50 will break a bone because of osteoporosis in their lives, which is really shocking. And that is important for girls and women to know throughout their lives, because for women, 90% of our peak bone mass is built by the time we're 18. So if we're inactive as girls, we're more likely to suffer from osteoporosis as women. And again, just to pick up on something that you mentioned in the intro in terms of mental health as well, we know that women are three times as likely to have the most common mental health problems than men. And the one that I find particularly shocking is self-harm amongst young women has tripled since 1993. And we can't let those stats continue in the direction that we're going. And sport has a role to play in all of these. But as well as kind of the moral imperative, if you like, of getting more women and girls active and happy and healthy, there's also the impact that all these levels of inactivity have on the NHS, particularly when we're talking about the amount that they have to spend on bone fractures in older women, which could absolutely be prevented. And as we are sort of a week out from a general election now, thinking about all the chat that there's been around getting more people into work and supporting more people to be healthy has to be part of that, even if it's not been mentioned so much in the debate. There's also I don't really like to talk about economics in this context, but it's undeniable that supporting more people back into work will help the economy, and we have to have good health to do that.
We've got a man in the room who's getting people into jobs and in a meaningful way in this sector. So Gary, let's take that economic point and unpack it a little bit. I mean, you yourself, you talk about you had what you describe as a punchy upbringing, and your work at Coach Corps is with people from disadvantaged groups. So let's speak to that sense of economy and the value of celebrating women and girls getting into sport, working in sport, all of the things that your organisation does.
I think it's such an interesting point. I mean, the statistics are awful that you've just spoken to there, Rachel. Obviously, you know, it's frightening, really, that this picture just isn't changing, or if it is, it's not changing quick enough. And I think so much of it can be traced back to those early experiences at school, you know, when we lose that relationship between play and sport, when we start to really look at the career pathways that are available, and all of a sudden there's doors shut off, particularly to marginalised young people, where it's a choice between one thing to survive day to day versus what they're actually going to take up as a professional career. And certainly from sport and physical activity, it's not given anywhere near the level of importance at the top level in this country around the things it can do. We have an understanding of the Olympics and the World Cups and these major marquee moments that, as we know, is such a small percentage of what that actually means. But actually those economic benefits of, you know, and there's been so many different sports and health reports around, if for every pound invested, you're going to be saving the economy £4 to £5, God knows what, you know, on the outside. And we see that within even the apprenticeship world, the young people that we're targeting, they're at risk of going down the wrong road. They're at risk of, you know, being joblessness. There's a number of different things. And we know that just by simply giving them a career that they can be passionate about, where they can feel like they can really put back some change into their local community, but that critically there's a long-term pathway available to them, it makes all the difference. It gives them back a sense of pride, particularly knowing that they're also then having a huge ripple effect on the people that they're working with.
You did some interesting research, you were telling me, during the COVID years. And the people who were on your apprenticeship courses, they missed that sense of belonging and that sense of doing something good for their community. I really hate how, as a society, often people are so negative about young people. And that really speaks to the sense that they value their community and they value making a difference, doesn't it?
Oh, completely. Yeah, I think it's probably the nicest misconception I get to bat down is these sorts of returns. So yeah, just sort of moving back again as a bit of a 101 for those that don't know, obviously apprenticeships are very much a vocational earn while you learn towards a tangible education. So there's, you know, anywhere 30 hours a week for a 12 to 18 month term, let's just say. And our chosen vehicle is around that community sport. So they are opening those different pathways and doors to them, but the give back to the community, the hours that they're spending is with Sport for Change, physical activity employers. Through lockdown, we surveyed our young people at the start, at the mid, and as we sort of exited the 2022 lockdown period. And they were asked what they missed most as one of their questions. And within that, they could have put their family and their friends, but actually they missed being part of the community, the coaching that they provide, that real sense of purpose. And I think unless you have come from a disadvantaged background where you are made to hear collectively no, shouldn't, couldn't, won't most of your life, to feel like you have some purpose and value, through a job that is bringing smiles and real meaning to other young people underneath you that are looking up to you as some superhero, it's so powerful. And I think, you know, if anything, if I could just wheel out one change maker to a site visit where they can see that in action, they would see the multiple differences across society that would have.
Let's talk about what happens in schools, because if we get this right in the early years in primary schools, then we can try and stop girls dropping out of sport. Mm. Our research at Women in Sport shows time and time again that girls drop out during puberty and during those early years of secondary school. Bella, at Well HQ, what are you doing to try and ensure that the support that's given to girls in school keeps them in sport?
I mean, the statistics show that 64% of girls drop out by the end of puberty of doing activity and exercise. When you think about it, you think, what are the reasons? Like, why? And there's so many reasons to it. There's things, because obviously puberty is such a massive change in a girl's body. So they start their periods. Often it's breast tenderness or breast pain, and they haven't got the right sports bra. Sports bras are not currently on kit lists at school. They start their periods, and those periods may have symptoms. They have all these changes going on that then either are embarrassing or shameful, or they don't know what to do, and therefore they stop. They'd rather just hide. So what we have to do is we have to educate the girls so that they understand they're normal, what's going on in their body. There is this incredible ebb and flow of hormones that is happening to them on an average 28-day cycle. And they need to start to learn to understand that that period that they see every month is actually not an inconvenience. It's a sign of good health, especially in active girls. Because in active girls, if they don't continue to have a regular period, or if they don't even start their period, if you don't start your periods, then that is also a sign that things aren't quite right. So it's important that these girls understand what is normal for them. They understand the language to use. So when they're describing their anatomy, for some reason, women's health is still surrounded with shame and stigma and embarrassment. And that has to change. We need to stop using these euphemisms and these nicknames for things. And once they know they're normal, they then know when things are not normal. And that's when they come and see me as their doctor, or they speak to their teachers or their coaches. But at the Well HQ, what we're trying to do is not just teach the girls. We want to teach the coaches and the teachers as well. And we always talk about the knowing-doing gap, because it's all very well giving someone the knowledge, but when you've got a 14-year-old girl in front of you, it's really hard to then say, oh, have you got your period? You know, it's really hard. How do you do that without there being any safeguarding issues or any, you know, there's a duty of care there, but there's also, it's awkward. So it's learning to give people the tools, the language, the ability to then say, right, rather than focusing on one, we're going to do this as a team. Here are period products. This is what we should be expecting. And then it sort of breaks down those barriers.
As a male coach, how difficult have you found it, Gary? Because I'm really interested to hear from somebody in your role. You've been a coach, I mentioned at the beginning, since you were 17 years old. Did you have to learn how to do this and how to feel comfortable around talking to girls about their bodies and understanding what they're going through and why their sport might be difficult at certain times?
Yeah, and embarrassingly, it came far too late in my coaching journey. I'd never fully appreciated it. It's such a strange thing that, again, we have this disconnect as to around what sport and physical activity is and then life, as if they're two very separate things. So with girlfriends growing up and stuff, knowing that they had periods and stuff, but not actually then associating that, heaven forbid, once a month the track athletes that I'm working with might not be on their top form that day. And I think even if you've got very forward-thinking, very empathetic coaches, male coaches of young females, it does strike me that the education is still not there for male coaches. Exactly to your point, Bella, like to have the confidence just to sort of like, how am I going to set this up? How do I have this conversation without feeling embarrassed, making them feel embarrassed, without saying or doing the wrong thing? So I think a lot of it, I'd love to think, isn't ignorance, and it's not a lack of understanding. Sorry, beg your pardon, lack of empathy. I think it's a complete lack of understanding as to how to approach the subject, how to have those conversations in a really healthy way. So that, you know, and Eilish McColgan is such a pin-up girl for this sort of stuff, you know, normalising this conversation, making male coaches sit up and realise this sort of stuff. So I think that, you know, there's still a very long way to go, because at the moment we're also talking about, you know, the individual sports where it's somewhat easier to have that coach-athlete relationship. The team sports, you know, those statistics are, as has already been presented today, are so low. I think that's even harder for those coaches to approach it. So, yeah, lots to be done still.
Rachel, you've articulated beautifully with
just the right number of statistics. What Women in Sport wants to say about inactivity and how harmful it is to women and girls. Let's start talking about some of the solutions here. What can be done? What are we calling for? What do we think the next government could do?
So there are a couple of things here. And I think just to stick on education initially, as Gary and Bella have already outlined beautifully, training is such a big thing, particularly when it comes to teachers and coaches. And been really, really good to hear how much school sport has been spoken about in politics, really thanks to the Lionesses, let's be honest, for putting it on the map. But it really is the training of the people who are going to be delivering that school sport that's the key thing. For example, if we increase the amount of PE that girls are having every week, but that PE is delivered by a teacher who doesn't understand gender stereotyping, who doesn't understand female puberty, that potentially is worse for the girls than just having 1 hour a week with a really brilliant teacher who completely understands it all. So training for us is definitely a big thing, and it needs to focus on absolutely the biology, particularly female puberty, but it also needs to focus on gender stereotyping and the impact that that can have as well. And I think this is particularly true for primary school teachers, who obviously are generalists. You don't get primary school PE teachers, and they have something like 4 to 6 hours in a year-long course of teacher training on how to teach PE.
That's on how to teach PE, not even getting into the close to how to teach girls PE and how to understand the unique biology of girls so that you can teach it well.
That is the other point. The majority of primary school teachers are female. And if they've had a shitty experience and a shitty relationship with sport their whole life as well, which obviously they are probably quite likely to have, then that's going to get passed on, you know, regardless of their intentions of being a fantastic teacher. And God knows I know how hard they all work.
Bella, well, HQ, you go into schools, you provide courses to do exactly this. Can it be done in the schools, in the system, without huge expense? Because any government is not going to want to spend money where it can do things without spending money. How do we make primary school sport better?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question, because everything costs money, doesn't it? Everything is tricky to fund these things. But we all should understand our bodies. And the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynaecologists a few years ago said that women are woefully uneducated about their bodies. And actually, it's something that if you can train the teachers or train the trainers, then it literally should have a knock-on effect. The money just needs to be redirected to women. And I think the trouble with women and with sport, often it's seen at the moment as being very charity based. It's not like men's sport where it's seen as a moneymaker or, you know, as an investment. It's very much it's a charity. These women are lucky to be doing sport. And actually, I think that has to change. I think that up until now, women were grateful for this space in sport and they wanted the same. They wanted it to be very much like, don't cause a fuss, we'll just fit in. We're so grateful to be here, we'll just fit in. We'll wear the men's kit, it's fine. Now, in the last few years, things have changed. It's like, actually, do you know what? We're not small men. We are completely different. And actually, we don't need to be grateful for being in this space. We should own our own space. We should belong here. This is our women's space, you know?
I've been asked this before, and if I could wave my magic wand, again, I don't know how many more reports we need to see that sport and physical activity at a primary age improves, you know, concentration, motivation, all of these different things. So it's far reaching across an entire education of a young person than just a bit of sport and meeting some minimum hours. That is my magic wand thing, like to make people understand the importance of it. And I think you touched upon it, Rachel, obviously, so many of the heads in the senior leadership team at primary school tend to be female. So if they've had poor experiences, they're not going to value it, and they're not going to, and the cycle continues and continues.
We spent a lot of the podcast talking about girls, and I think that's really valid. But I'd like to spend the rest of the time, if we can, moving on to the other life stages. Rachel, if we come back to women in sport, what are we asking for?
One of the biggest things that government could do is just integrate sport and physical activity into women's health strategies. They are a relatively recent invention, I say, as if women's health has only just been discovered. But it is definitely a positive move that governments have these now. But they're still kind of in a little box over there. And sport and physical activity is in a different little box, completely in an opposite direction. And those boxes need to come together. Getting more women active will save the government money in the long run. If we could just get more women active, it's a benefit for government too. And integrating it into women's health strategies would cost them £0 and zero pence.
Let's bring the GP in to talk about the later life stages, midlife, menopause, older age, wiser life, as I think we rightly call it these days. What needs to happen for women and sport and exercise? And I love the way you just call it moving my body.
Yeah.
What needs to happen so that we can feel these benefits all the way through our lives?
I always say this to my patients. It's a marathon. We've got to live a long, healthy life. We've got to get to the end of it strong, with balance. We've got to not fall over. We need our bones to be strong. As you said, Rachel, we lay them down in our teens. We cannot sacrifice our youngsters at the detriment of sport, or from over-exercising and under-fueling, or not understanding how to fuel their body. We need to be in it for the long term. But it doesn't have to be a certain sport. You don't have to be prescriptive and say, you have to do this, you have to do that. It's move your body, enjoy being in your body. I think for women, we've always thought of sport and exercise as controlling our weight, how we look. We need to change that and rebrand it as, how does it make you feel? What is it going to do in the long term to help you benefit? You know, and our post-menopause, estrogen levels drop, our bones can get thinner, we need our heart, our cardiovascular risk goes up, you know, there's risk of falls, we need to stay independent. It is just so important to keep strong, keep active, keep confident. It's good for our mental health, physical health, hormone health, everything.
The shame that we have been made to feel about our bodies at some point in our lives, whether we were sporty at school or whether we were not, and we carry it forever.
Yeah.
How do we deal with that? You use the word obliterate on your website, and I love the idea that we are not going to tolerate this anymore.
Yeah. It is still surrounded with shame and stigma. And it is often these euphemisms, these kind of the detachment. I'm not going to talk or label something how it should be. I'm an ambassador for the Eve Appeal, which is a gynae cancer charity. I'm very proud of that because it's smashing these stigmas, being able to normalise this conversation and talk about things. It's just so important.
Bella, let's pick up on another thought about the different life stages. I was chatting with a friend the other day, I hadn't seen her in a while, and we were talking about sport. And she said, you know, have you ever played cricket? And I said, no, we didn't get a chance to do it as a child. And we were wondering whether we might go and join the local cricket club. And she said, the trouble is, I've had three children and I cannot run without weeing. And I said to her, this is not a good thing to avoid sport because of that. Pelvic floor, women's life stages, these are things that we've got to address, because women will avoid sport if they think that's going to happen to them. What do you say to those women?
I am so pleased that you brought this up, because the pelvic floor, I personally think, is the most important group of muscles in the entire body. I know your heart is important, but your pelvic floor is really very important, especially as women. And I think for some reason, the women who have just had a baby, it's allowed. You're allowed to talk about it. You're allowed to talk about it postpartum or when you're jumping on a trampoline with your two-year-old. But there are women who are doing sport at the age of 18, 19, 20 who leak urine. There are gymnasts, there are runners who leak urine because they are not taught how to strengthen their pelvic floor.
I'm doing the exercises while
you're
speaking.
So am I.
Are you ready?
So am I. And that is why it should be educated in school. Girls need to understand that they have this group of muscles. And obviously it is intimate and it is sensitive and we mustn't ever abuse that. But we need to make sure that women and girls know that it's there. And we know that after the menopause, estrogen levels drop. And one of the first places where that becomes so apparent is in the pelvic floor, because there are so many estrogen receptors. I personally think that every single woman after her mid-40s should be given vaginal estrogen. As a matter of just, everyone should have it, just to strengthen the pelvic floor so that they can run. But I think that women's health physios are an undervalued resource. They are absolutely brilliant. And I send so many of my patients to see women's health physios, because they will one-to-one help women understand their pelvic floor and make sure that they're doing their pelvic floor exercises correctly. And the reason I say that is often with athletes and active women, that in their head they think the stronger the better. And actually, you have to learn to be able to relax it as well. You have to be able to relax it so that you can pass urine and open your bowels and do all those sort of things, as well as strengthen it. So it's kind of a really important organ that you get right and don't just make it tighter and tighter and tighter. As a GP, obviously, I see from birth to death, I see every life stage, and I see women who are in their 80s and 90s who have prolapses. You know, this is something that we shouldn't have to see. They should be able to prevent it. And it's just a case of educating and showing them how to do it and making sure that we know how important it is.
I mentioned that I was doing the exercises as you were speaking. Rachel was doing the exercises as you... What is the exercise for anyone who doesn't know how to exercise their pelvic floor?
So you basically need to imagine lifting your pelvic floor off the gutter of your underwear. Imagine you're walking out into the water, like the sea, and the water's coming up your thighs, okay? And there are little fish that are nibbling at you under the water, and you think, oh my God, and you lift yourself, you lift your pelvic floor, your vulva, your vagina, you lift it up so that the fish can't nibble at you. And that is what a pelvic floor exercise feels like. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that, and often you need to do it lying down first to make sure that you're engaging the muscles correctly, but it's basically that sensation. And then you have to be able to lift it and hold it, so like for 10 seconds, then relax. But you also need to be able to pulse it, so you need to be able to lift and relax, lift and relax. So imagine, say, an elevator or a lift going up to the fifth floor, and then you come down to the fourth, the third, the second, the first, and then you're on the ground floor. Then you do it again, up to the fifth floor, the fourth, the third, like that. And then, you know, so you understand that there's lots of ways that you can do it. And it's not just the vagina, the vulva, there's the anal section as well. Imagine lifting up a Malteser with your anus and then taking it forward and dropping it.
You can join in now, Carrie.
And you have one of those. Can I just say that men do have pelvic floors as well? And actually men can have, it can help with erectile dysfunction and all sorts of things like that, and with prostate. Mm-hmm. But men don't realise, or they don't feel it's as important perhaps as women. But it is important.
Did you know you had a pelvic floor?
No,
as well?
Absolutely not. I know that now I need to put another workout on my sessions every week. So there we go.
Brilliant. Gary, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you would really like to say that you think is important to have in this podcast?
I think for me, we tend to knee-jerk a lot of things. So say, for example, we get our way and we make politicians start talking about this, and all of a sudden, you know, we've got everyone doing what I call the 2012 effect. So we've got the legacy, we've got the ripple effect. Everyone wants to go out and try sport, and then they turn up to the club and the club is definitely not ready. We've had a lot of learning in the 12 years that we've been running Coach Corps, but the biggest one is definitely the kind of those role models and those change makers. So from the very smallest micro community club through to the major national governing bodies, they need to be asking themselves, if you're going to fly this flag around getting more women and girls into your sport, into your club, into your community, who is the first person they meet? Because we've got to stop talking numbers and we've got to start talking names. Because if the first experience on the first day is negative, they're not coming back. And as much as I would love, you know, we've got stories till the hills of incredible young female apprentices that have left an incredible legacy behind them of the work that they've done, even after they've graduated Coach Corps. But if they're not educated and they're not running the right sessions, that's where male allies can step in and support some of that, and vice versa. So I would just sort of have a plea to anyone that's kind of thinking about it, reflecting on their own clubs and their own practices. If you were to join your club tonight, who would be the first person they meet through the door? And I think anybody in every club can do that for free, no money, just to start to make sure that that positive journey starts from the moment someone has the courage and the bravery to step up and come in through your door.
I love that. That's it for this episode of the Women in Sport podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please remember to like, subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts, and delve into our archive of dozens of interviews and discussions about women in sport. Many thanks to Whistledown Productions in London, where this podcast was recorded. If you'd like to donate to our charity, please do give whatever you can at womeninsport.org. You can find us on all the usual socials, including Instagram, X, LinkedIn and TikTok. And you can go to our website, womeninsport.org, to sign up to our newsletter, donate to the charity and get involved in our work. Thanks for listening. And remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfilment and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.